this is Kendra Brodeen, founder and CEO of WomenLawyersOnline.com, and today I am delighted to bring you J. Kim Wright, who goes by Kim, and I'd love to share a little bit of information about her with you before I bring her on the call. So J. Kim Wright is a pioneer in the field of law as a healing profession. A graduate of the University of Florida College of Law, she passed the North Carolina Bar in 1994, her third successful bar exam, and the only membership that she currently maintains. She was one of she was the original founder of the Renaissance Lawyer Society, a nonprofit organization of lawyers, quote, supporting legal transformation and innovation. And wrote their original website of almost 400 pages of information. The RLS site showcased ways of practicing law that were solution-oriented, collaborative, restorative, peacemaking, and healing, and promoted the new approaches as a movement and a new paradigm of law. Since late 1999, she has been speaking, writing, and interacting with lawyers about this new paradigm of law. She is widely recognized as one of the leaders defining and guiding the movement. In her work, she has met thousands of lawyers and has developed meaningful connections with key leaders who are influential with thousands of other lawyers. She has consulted with the media, mainstream, professional, and alternative. After years of working in the field, she identified the need for a central information resource in a virtual community center. She launched CuttingEdgeLaw.com in March 2009. As the publisher and managing editor of CuttingEdgeLaw.com, she and her business partner, Michael Matthews, have interviewed over 100 lawyers, law professors, law students, judges, and allied professionals who are working to create a new paradigm of legal practice. CuttingEdgeLaw.com combines her commitment to a new model of law with years of study of transformational technology, social construction, conflict resolution, socially responsible business, human dynamics, neuroscience, and learning theory. Kim coaches lawyers on transforming their law practices and helping lawyers find their authentic voice and tell the whole truth about who they are, what they're doing, and why they're doing it. She develops continuing legal education programs and has published many articles and chapters in magazines and books. She's involved with several think tanks and support circles and is working on a documentary series about law. She has also been an adjunct professor at three colleges, including her alma mater, Warren Wilson College in Asheville, where she majored in business management and international studies. In November of 2009, the ABA named Kim as one of the 50 legal rebels who are, quote, finding new ways to practice law, represent their clients, adjudicate cases, and train the next generation of lawyers, end quote. In 2009, the American Bar Association contacted Kim to author a book detailing this new paradigm in law, Lawyers as Peacemakers, Practicing Holistic Problem-Solving Law, was released in April 2010 and has reached the ABA bestseller list from pre-orders alone. It was also named one of the 50 flagship books for the American Bar Association. And I wanted to read a quick quote about the book from Scott Wolf, who is a performance and leadership consultant. And he wrote, quote, J. Kim Wright is a very strong example of a gravitational core of conversation whereby the conversations that constitute restorative justice find her, and the more they find her, the more mass there is, and thus more conversations tend to find her, end quote. In addition to her professional accomplishments, Kim has raised 16 children, two birth children, plus stepchildren and other children who have needed a home. Kim started law school with seven children at home, ages spanning 2 to 16 years old. Her title has since expanded to include grandmother, and her oldest grandson just became a father. In spring 2008, Kim gave up her home and office and began to travel full-time. Since then, she has spent time in 27 states and was interviewed in Key West, Florida. So, Kim, I am delighted to welcome you to the call and get this chance to have a conversation with you.
Thanks so much for having me, Kendra.
You are very welcome. Well, with that, let's just launch into the questions, and I know we'll probably meander around and have a great conversation around learning from your experience and your professional and your personal journey, which sounds fascinating as well. So the first question is, I would like to look back at your personal history, in your life, your personal history and your journey in law school and in your career. And I'm wondering if during that time you found that you were good all along at balancing your work and your life, or if there seemed to be a pivotal point in time or a certain circumstance that helped you or forced you to make a decision to do things in a different way, to juggle that balance between personal and professional?
Well, Kendra, I think that if there happened to be one circumstance, it was the birth of my first child. When I was only 19, and I soon went back to college, and just found that that there were not enough hours in the day. I was a full-time student. I worked. I had a child, I wasn't able to do everything, and so I started having to set my priorities. I had to find ways of taking care of myself so I could take care of other people. And so that was sort of the beginning. I don't remember ever having any issue with being too busy before
mm-hmm.
that. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, it was sort of the new responsibilities of motherhood were sort of the turning point for me. And then over the years, I obviously from my bio had many other children living with me, and had to set priorities and had to find ways of balancing my life and living according to my values so that I could just survive the roller coaster of all of it.
Yeah, it sounds like you said, there was that pivotal point, but then certainly, and in your bio, that's it's amazing to me. I just have two small children, and so to see that you've had 16, and the way they've come into your life and been a part of your life, it's amazing. And I can only imagine how that really forced you in a way to figure out your own priorities, like you said, set your priorities and find that balance.
Yeah, there are so many things you could do. You know, mm-hmm. I love those mm-hmm. those little signs that people put on their walls about. I'm trying to remember the exact one. There's one that talks about being able to keep a clean house or actually have a life. Mm-hmm. It's not that I became a pig, but I certainly didn't scrub the inside of the refrigerator nearly as much with seven kids at home as I did with only one.
Yeah, exactly. Did you do it with one? Because you're beating me then.
Oh, I'm an overachiever.
Okay.
So when my son was an infant, I actually stayed home with him for several months, and I recall making my own salad dressing and mayonnaise, and I made all my own bread.
Wow.
I was the super achiever, so I probably did scrub the inside of the refrigerator at that point. Thank God I found things that would occupy my time better.
Well, I do love that what you shared in terms of, you know, making the choices between, like you said, a clean house or having a life. Just saying there, I could spend 15, 20 minutes, a half hour, an hour doing this, or I could make a choice and do it in another way that maybe actually serves my priorities and my values better.
Right, right.
So what would you say then, Kim, looking back or even just in your current life and your current work, what has been your biggest challenge or struggle that you've experienced in terms of trying to create that personal and professional balance? What has been the biggest challenge to you?
Well, I think it actually does have to do with my values, and that I am not at all money motivated. I for me, it's something that I have to handle, and I would much prefer to do something else than pay attention to the details. And so I find myself getting involved in things that are really a lot of fun that don't have any financial return at all, and I make choices which are much easier now that my children are grown to go ahead and go with that rather than saying, oh well, that's not producing any money right now, so I'm not going to pay attention to that. So a lot of my projects, like I've actually been working on several documentary series, and maybe one will happen, maybe none of them will happen. But if they do happen, it's going to make a huge difference in the movement and reaching the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so I make those kinds of choices, and so when I'm always living on the edge, there are times when I kind of tip off.
Tell me more about that. Or not. You know? It's kind of intriguing.
Well, for example, I took off several months to write the book. Well, I'm not a trust baby. I used to work in Asheville, where many of my clients were trust babies, and they took on all kinds of jobs and started businesses because they didn't have to worry about money. Knowing the financial workings of a lot of the business owners in a small town, I realized that very few people were actually making a living, but they were having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
So I'm not in that category. And so, if I take 3 months off to work on a project, there's no income coming in.
Right.
And so that requires, at the very least, tightening the belt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of why I have chosen to travel full time, because I don't want the responsibility of a mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want the responsibility of all of the things that come with being in one place, and you know, paying an office space and all of that, and I very consciously said I can work at practicing law or some other more lucrative kind of project and have all of those things, or I can follow my passion 100% and with an idea that it is going to be lucrative in the long run, but in the short run, it's actually just started to turn around. But in our first year, we didn't even have a website to earn income. We traveled full time and did the interviews and created the content with no safety net.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. So
if I had been money oriented, money motivated, if that had been a high value for me, I would probably not have done it the way I did it, and I'm grateful that I did. So,
mm-hmm.
But it is challenging.
Well, right, and that's the hard thing is, even for those of us who aren't really driven by the almighty dollar, unfortunately, you know, push comes to shove, you still got to feed yourself and put a roof over your head, and I mean, to some extent, and so there do come those hard choices, but it sounds like at least you weren't so money-centric that it prevented you from doing the work that you love and that you really want to do. You were able to figure out a way to make that work, not without challenges, but
right.
Would have been, had you had your priorities different, you probably wouldn't have even had the freedom to explore what you're doing right now.
Right, right.
So, Kim, then what would you say on the flip side of that, you know, we looked at your biggest challenge, what would you say your biggest lesson or what you've learned over the course of your journey has been in creating that personal and professional meaning and success, whatever that looks like for you, what has been your biggest lesson?
That I'm not so unique and special. Mm-hmm. That the things that I experienced in the legal profession, when I was practicing law, I thought I was all alone, that nobody else was having those kinds of thoughts, that they weren't struggling with that the legal profession is this huge morass of conversations and ways that we're supposed to act, and our parents thought finally we've become lawyers, have these ideas about what that means, and there are all these societal pressures and all of that, and I thought I was the only one that felt those. And when I started actually authentically sharing about them, I realized that I wasn't the only one, and that there are actually this whole movement, and I would say even more than a movement, it's a reaction to the legal profession not working.
Mm-hmm.
And that by sharing that, as I was able to distinguish for myself the things that didn't work and the other options, I discovered that there were lots and lots of people who had the same experiences. And so when I find myself having some particular kind of struggle, instead of keeping it to myself, I now share it. It's kind of ironic, because the very things that I thought that I needed to be ashamed of or hide are the things that have people drawn to me.
Right.
Because then they can share with me what's going on with them. And I've talked with thousands of lawyers who have told me very similar stories. At one point, I talked to two lawyers in one firm. They actually turned out to have offices down the hall from each other. And they were calling me for advice because there was nobody in their firm that thought like they did.
Oh, wow.
And so here they are separately calling me, and I finally managed to have the conversation about confidentiality in a way that didn't reveal anything, but gave me permission to tell them that there was a friend right down the hall having the very same experience.
Oh,
and so it's the emperor has no clothes,
mm-hmm.
Over and over again, and so I'm just willing to say that's the emperor has no clothes, and to get that all out in the open.
And like you said, I'm sure that others are drawn to you because of that transparency and the freedom that they then feel, because they realize they're not alone. And I do find that is amazing that you were able to connect people down the hall from one another who thought that they were in silos, who had that feeling that they were completely alone. And that's what, I'm finding as well with women lawyers, is they all think that they're all just suffering in silence, thinking that they need to rise. And back to what you were saying, that there's all these expectations and pressures from the firm, from what society thinks lawyers should be, from our families, from all of that. And so we just stuff it all down inside and assume that everyone else is just perfect and we are the ones that are suffering and something's wrong with us. But that's why with the work you're doing and letting people see you and experience you through your blog and thus realize that they're not suffering alone, that other people, it's a very normal feeling. It's a gift, I think, to others to realize that they're not the only ones.
Well, and Kendra, the thing that is ironic about this is because I'm always comparing myself to other people as being not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like I look at, oh well, that person is doing more than me, or look at that, she built a house for Habitat for Humanity. What a wonderful thing to do. or I've got one friend I say that reading her resume is guaranteed to send anybody into therapy. Okay. She's got an LLM, and she's traveled around the world, and all of that kind of stuff. But I think women lawyers are facing even more of that, because you even said it on the call. It's like, well, I only had two kids.
Right.
Here we are. We're
right.
We compare ourselves, and I have to say, having six, I only had eight kids at home at any one time, but over the years there were 16 of them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of work.
I can't even imagine.
And there were a lot of choices that I made that of things that I didn't do. And I think we all have 24 hours in a day. We all have 7 days a week. And it really is a lot about making those choices about where we're going to put our time. And we can't make them because somebody else wants us to make them,
mm-hmm.
because then we're just going to be miserable. And so we have to listen to ourselves and say, that is what I want to do, and this is where I want to spend my time. And then recognize our own strengths and shortcomings, and be okay with the choices we make.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when we make when we see somebody who's made a choice that we think we might should have made, that we are concerned about it.
Exactly, and right, and that it causes problems. Like you said, what works for you or for me or for anybody else is not necessarily the best fit for another person. They have their own best fit that they can find and that works for them and serves them and gives them meaning in their life and fulfillment in their career, and they're going to make different choices. And if, like you said, if reading a resume or something drives you to do something that is actually not something that you feel called to do in your heart or in your gut, but you do it just because you feel there's an expectation or you need to do it to prove something to somebody who probably doesn't even care, but you feel like they care, and you go off and do that, that's when we get led astray, and then we feel the unpleasantness and the discomfort and the frustration, the overwhelm, because we've been pulled off of our own course.
Right, right. And my path is not someone else's path,
mm-hmm.
and their path is not mine.
Right.
I guess one of the things I've learned is not to judge someone else's path. And hope that they don't judge mine.
Oh, exactly. Oh, so if that then was sort of, well, and several things in there, but in terms of your biggest lesson, are there two or three or however many you really want, but just a few tips or strategies, maybe some tactical or practical things that you found, or even just ways of thinking about things that have served you as you've created your own work-life integration and alignment and balance?
Sure. I particularly like the image of the bicycle for balance, because if you're watching somebody ride a bicycle that rides a lot, it just looks so smooth. But when you're a child learning to ride a bicycle, you have to learn to lean one way and then the other, and you know, push down hard on one side, and then and that's the way you move forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's by leaning side to side. And so for me, balance is about that. It's about sometimes I go too far one way and then I bring myself back upright and maybe go too far the other way. So it's a constant readjustment. And there's a lawyer in Texas, John McShane, who talks about conscious imbalance, which I really love. And he's a litigator, and so he says when he's in litigation, he's just there. He's there, you know, morning, noon, and night. Stays late, and his attention is on the trial. But what he does is he schedules downtime afterwards. So he maybe has a couple of days to catch up in his office, but then he has a week of vacation with his family.
Mm-hmm.
So he consciously goes out of balance one way and then consciously goes out of balance the other, so that overall in the course of a year he has balance in his life. So that's sort of two different ways of looking at balance that are, you know, have a lot in common that I use as guideposts. I think the other thing that I've been writing quite a bit about vicarious trauma, and lawyers deal with people's problems all the time. I mean, some lawyers deal with big problems like murder cases or you know, something like that, and some people deal with business issues. But for our clients, those are big problems, no matter how they look to us. They don't hire a lawyer unless it's something that's really important, it stresses them out, and they bring that to us, and they expect us to fix it. And so it's kind of like they bring this bucket full of stress and you know, the loss of liberty or money or whatever, and they put it on our desk and say, handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of them, it's their only problem, but we have everybody's problems all over our desks. And when you're dealing with that time and time again, it takes a toll on us personally. So I recommend that you spend a whole lot more downtime than you think you need to be able to restore yourself. I used to work in restorative justice and work with the families of murder victims and the murderers and bring them face to face. And when I was doing that kind of work, I needed days of recovery time after doing a couple of hours of that. It took everything I had, and I wasn't available to anybody until I could replenish myself. And I think that we lawyers need to really pay attention to that and what it is we in particular need. Some people may be able to do that kind of work and not need a couple of days to recover or several days to recover. Not me. I couldn't even watch The Waltons on TV because it was too violent after dealing with some of those cases. I just my circuits overloaded, and I had to find ways to take care of myself and really pamper myself to be able to recover. And I think that what we do is important work, and we need not to apologize for needing to take care of ourselves to do it.
That's so, and the phrase that you use is vicarious trauma. I mean, we are, as lawyers, there when people are facing traumatic situations in their lives of a huge variety. But regardless, if they weren't having some sort of problem, they really wouldn't be in our offices. And
right.
So we're absorbing that. And I just think that's excellent advice. And I actually was going to ask you, and maybe this is a little bit of a segue, I know that you wrote a chapter in the book that you just released on taking care of ourselves as lawyers. And is that sort of part and parcel of what you're saying here? I'd love to hear more about that. I think it's so important.
Well, it's actually, I think, the biggest chapter. The book is 528 pages. It's called Lawyers as Peacemakers, Practicing Holistic Problem-Solving Law. And because practicing holistically requires taking care of everybody, and that includes ourselves, as I said, I think it's the largest chapter. And so I look at things like the vicarious trauma chapter, and I have meditation and self-awareness, and I touch on the things that we all know. I'm not the expert, but talk about like getting enough sleep, those kinds of things that that most of us aren't doing in our culture, and just expressing our emotions and being healthy with our emotions. So there's a lot there.
Okay.
And the book also has an overview of what is the paradigm, what is the paradigm shift, and what are some of the ways that people are practicing the paradigm shift. So I look at things like restorative justice and collaborative law and therapeutic jurisprudence and holistic law and problem-solving law. And so there's this whole range of new at least newer approaches to law that are more holistic and healthier for everybody, including society. And so I look at that, and then I also look at some of the skills that someone needs to practice in that new paradigm. So the book's actually, it was really fun to do because I wrote a lot of it myself, but then I also pulled in some experts who wrote about like the neuroscience parts of emotion. And about meditation and I have profiles of lawyers who are doing this work, so that there are real people that we can actually look to as role models. And then I have well over 50 pages of resources. So it's kind of one of those books that you don't have to pick it up and read it from front to back. You can actually pick it up and spend 5 minutes and just kind of open it up and find something that that looks interesting and get kind of a dose of holistic law and then go on with the rest of your day without having to get too involved. There's a little bit of academic writing in there, and there's also a lot of just plain old storytelling.
It's an incredible resource, and to have that much information. And I love the fact that, like you said, you can pick it up and glean something in a very short period of time, which is perfect for the lifestyles of lawyers and people that we're talking about, where you don't have to feel like you need to commit 2 or 3 hours to reading, where you can pick it up in 5 minutes and learn something, and something it sounds like that is very practical that you can implement in your own life to make a difference. Maybe right away you can find something new without investing an incredible amount of time.
Right.
Where would you, I see on your website that they, folks can order the book through your website. Is that correct? Or is there another place you'd like to direct them to do that if they wanted to check it out?
Right now it's only available through the ABA for the next several months. There is a link on my website on cuttingedgelaw.com that takes you to the ABA site.
Okay, great. So you can get it through the ABA because it does, I'm definitely going to grab a copy because I think it sounds just amazing. And also, and it's probably the topic of another call, but just the whole idea of the problem-solving law and holistic practicing of law as a new paradigm, as a new shift and a way of doing things that, like you said, is gaining incredible visibility and traction as people realize that the old model is broken and we need to do something different. And you're a real leader in bringing this to the forefront, and also with the creation of the documentaries, as you mentioned, just bringing out that new idea of what the legal profession can and maybe should look like in the future, because things are not working as they are.
Well, it's about what's possible in the law. Mm-hmm. Like the question that guides us is, what if lawyers were peacemakers, problem solvers, and healers of conflicts?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What would society look like if that is what we took on as our role?
Right. Wow, it's a powerful question. It really, I mean, it just changes the way you think about the profession of law, and certainly ourselves as lawyers. I mean, even just, you feel something almost physically shift when you think about yourself as a lawyer with that motivation and that self-identity versus the more adversarial personification and persona that we're used to embracing as lawyers that makes us feel tight and combative and competitive. But if it were more about that problem solving and that peacemaking, not in sort of a soft, squishy way, because you still get results, but it's where you come from in your motivation and in your spirit, bringing it to the situations that you're facing. I don't know. It made me feel sort of a little bit lighter just thinking about being a lawyer that came from it from that perspective.
Right, and it doesn't it definitely doesn't have to be that squishy, fluffy kind of law, because we're looking for solutions.
Right.
So one of the things I'm fond of saying is that I'm really glad that Rosa Parks did not mediate her problem with the bus company. That was a problem that was worth taking on.
Right.
And using the litigation system to handle. If somebody is dumping toxic waste in a river above where my children live, I want them to stop. We can talk later.
Mm-hmm.
But I want an injunction.
Right.
And so that, you know, it's not that we don't have the court as one of our tools, but it's not the first place we go if we're trying to resolve something about the neighbor's fence.
Right.
That
exactly.
If we're going to continue to live there, we need to find some way to live together as neighbors.
Mm. So true. So true. It seems like it's a bit situation dependent, where generally there are those places where it makes all the sense in the world to come to the problem with a sense of the problem solving, the holistic, the peacemaking. But like you said, there are situations where we just need to put our foot down and things need to stop, and we need to employ the courts. We need to do something that comes from a place of a bit more force, because the question is so imperative and so timely and so important. So is that your sense? Is that it depends a bit on the situation?
Well, I think it has to do with something that I after I wrote my book, I read a book called The Anatomy of Peace that I'm just a missionary about now, because in that book they talk about this paradigm shift that happens, and it's really articulately and elegantly done in the book, and I'm not going to do it justice. Mm-hmm. But if your heart is in the right place, you have a heart at peace, and you're looking for problem solving and healing, there are a lot of actions that you can take that are the same behaviors that you would take if you were in a place where your heart is at war.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a much different result. It's actually one of the things that I learned in dealing with the children that I raised. A lot of these were kids that their parents had kicked them out because they were oppositional, or they had all kinds of labels, and they just literally, they were street kids that we brought home and took into our family. And I never had any problem with them, because I actually came from a place where I just loved them and I accepted them, and we had conversations about how I wanted things, and they just jumped through all kinds of hoops to please me, because they knew that I was coming from that place. And in their relationships with their parents, they had really gotten to that place where it was just completely adversarial, and their parents weren't coming from that love anymore. They were coming from their frustration and their anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Anatomy of Peace, they actually look at various behaviors and how we might still go to war, but from that problem solving place.
Well, I'm definitely going to check out that book, because it does sound elegantly done and so important. Is that it's not, like you said, that the actions themselves change, but that the motivations and the heart and the spirit that we bring to the actions change,
right.
And that changes the whole situation, and that changes the response as well. And like you said, with the children, or I can see, you know, in some sort of legal situation too, we may say the same words, we may take the same actions even, but they'll be received differently when clients or opposing counsel or who knows that we're coming from a different place, that we're not
right.
Just trying to stomp on them, that we're coming from a place of problem solving. It shifts everything.
Right, right.
Kim, I'm conscious of time, and I feel like I could talk to you for a really long time. I'm fascinated with your work and with all you've done and all you are doing. But I am conscious of time, and I'd love to give you a chance to talk a little bit about Cutting Edge Law or other things that you're working on, and let readers and listeners know more about the work that you're up to.
So Cutting Edge Law is really the home of all of these conversations that I've been talking about. It's about the different approaches. It's about all the kinds of things that we want to talk about after we go through a paradigm shift. People write about meditation. They write just sort of their authentic voice. We had a blog last week on play. And how it is that we feel like we need reasons to play and the value of play. So those are the kinds of things. It's pretty eclectic. We've got about 2,000 documents and our 100 and I think it's 102 different interviews actually are in 10-minute clips. We have 343 clips, I think, as of today, of lawyers who have been grappling with these issues and have been the real trailblazers and pioneers and leaders of a movement. They're role models for all of us on how to design a law practice or a way of being in the law that really is values-based and makes a difference. And so those are on the site. We have memberships, and actually Anatomy of Peace in my book are membership premiums right now for people who can come in and actually be part of the community. I just created a brand new community page so that you can actually go in and just read about what people want you to know about them. And I'm fascinated by the people in this movement, because every bio I read, it's like, oh my gosh, I really want to know that person, and which is how I ended up traveling and meeting all these people. And so that's Cutting Edge Law is that kind of center. It also gives me a vehicle for having the conversations with the media and talking to them about, look at how broad this movement is. Look how interesting these people are. And so I spend a lot of my day kind of being the PR person for the movement, and that's why I get involved with the documentaries. And so right now I have a project to get our bloggers seen by more people, and so I've become very involved with some of the major media in that way, and I also end up talking to people a lot. The first year that I was working on the Renaissance Lawyer side, I was just interviewing people, and I ended up literally spending the equivalent of a full-time job for a lawyer, not a 40-hour week, but a full-time job for a lawyer, just having calls one after another, an hour apiece, with people who wanted to talk about what they were doing. And out of that grew a coaching practice, and so I particularly like working with clients who are wanting to bring all of these new models into their practice, and so the site provides some of that too.
That's great. Sorry, I was kind of bopping around in there, and it's an amazing place, a variety, just a treasure trove of resources.
And I always say that since I had 16 children, I always have to have 16 projects going.
Yeah.
And now that they're grown.
Right. 16 new children.
and so the site kind of gives me the structure for that.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. It's just great, Kim. Excellent. Well, I definitely encourage anyone to readers, listeners, anyone, and I will be promoting it as well, to check out cuttingedgelaw.com, because it is, there's so much here, and I need to close that browser right now, because I'm just getting sucked into how many things I want to read and look at, and people I want to know. Like you said, I just see what people are writing about and doing, and I think, gosh, they're just fascinating people. And like you said earlier on in the conversation, it's one of those places, like knowing that we're not alone in our, and maybe our suffering or our challenges or our frustrations, we're not alone in thinking about these things either. When you
right.
Just that other people, bright, wonderful, capable, exciting people, are thinking and wondering the same things that we are. And so to know that is really empowering too.
Well, and there's one more thing I want to say about this, because this has been a theme in the last few weeks for me. So I have been suddenly in the last few weeks, I have been the gravitational core for conversations around psychics and law.
Mm.
Now, that is kind of about as far out there as you get. But if you talk to a psychic lawyer, it is a completely different experience, because they're not flaky at all.
Right.
They are so evidence-based, and they talk about, in terms of, well, this is a gift, and I felt like I needed to learn about it. And so they know all of the backstory, and they can make their case, and it doesn't sound weird anymore. And so there's this whole role of lawyers as bridging the gap into sort of the more esoteric, metaphysical, spiritual realms that I've just become fascinated with, because we do have such good minds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I so appreciate the ability to have conversations about things that I'm just curious about. I love neuroscience. I love appreciative inquiry. But I'm really curious about the intuition and the spectrum that includes empathy and all of the neuroscience is beginning to point to things that I think actually tie to being psychic. And so as I look at that, I think, gosh, who else is even thinking about that? And then I find lawyers are.
Ah, oh, neat. Yes.
And it's like who would have thought that I would now have in my circle of close acquaintances a dozen mediums and psychics who are lawyers, and they don't seem weird at all.
No. And like you said, that you thought that maybe you were the only one asking the question or thinking the thoughts or wondering, and yet here now all these people have come into your life, and I'll bet, when you start to maybe put out there in terms of blogs or articles or who knows, and people are, then it gives others permission to say, oh, I was a little curious about that too, but I was always afraid to say it, it's just
exactly.
It opens it up.
Exactly, which is why I'm actually saying it on this call, because
yeah.
you know, I... One of the things I told a judge in Asheville once, we had just met, and I could tell that my reputation had preceded me. Mm-hmm. And I told him it was always my goal to be the weirdest lawyer in town so no one else had to worry about it.
You take the pressure off everyone else.
Yeah. And so I will say the things that nobody else will say, so that then that gives them, you know, a whole gap that they can talk about things in and not be labeled.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being brave enough to be that person, because it allows others to speak some of their truth and the questions that, and I loved reading them, you know, the truth about who they are and what they're doing and why they're doing it, those sorts of questions and other questions, but to ask them and not just hide away wondering if they're the only, believing that they're the only one who's thinking these things. So,
right.
So thank you for that. And thank you for the time today, Kim. I'm beyond delighted to talk with you. I look forward to many more conversations with you if you're willing, because I'm just fascinated by all the work you're doing, and I look forward to getting to know you better. But this has been just a great conversation, and I know that folks who are listening and reading it will gain so much from your experiences and what you've shared, the wisdom you've shared, the advice that you've given, and the work that you're doing, opening up those conversations and those places that maybe until now have been a little bit dark and shadowy and secretive, and bringing those places to light to the benefit of everyone who encounters you. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great time.
Well, thank you, and me too. I've enjoyed it very much. So with that, we'll sign off for today. I look forward to being here again soon. But until then, this is Kendra Brodine signing off and wishing you success always and in all ways. Thank you so much for being here. Bye-bye.